You're listening to Sipping on Some Crime podcast, hosted by Aaron. This podcast covers sensitive and triggering subjects, explicit language, and mature content which may not be suitable for children. As always, all parties are innocent until proven guilty.
Today, I will be covering the case of Gail Schultz and Paul Jr. Schultz. Gail Schultz, 18, and Paul Jr. Schultz, 12, would be murdered just yards from their back door in broad daylight in a small housing community with no witnesses. At first, everyone thought they had drowned, but soon it would be discovered that this was not a drowning, but a homicide. The case faced challenges from the beginning, and 70 years later, it's still unsolved. Gail Schultz at 18 was said to be her little brother Paul Schultz's constant companion and only playmate. Gail, being the older sister by 6 years, was very protective of Paul, 12, who was born with developmental delays. Gail, whose mother shortly passed after birth, was known to her family and her school as a promising artist who often took her little brother Paul Jr., whose nickname was Butchie, outside to allow him to play while she often painted the beautiful scenery around her. Gail would often take Paul to walk along the beautiful creek that ran across their yard in the new housing development East Lawn Gardens, located about 2 miles northwest of Nazareth, Pennsylvania. The Schultz family had decided to move to this new development just over a year ago because at the time, they were living in the center of a busy town and they wanted open space for Paul Jr. to be able to play in. Neighbors would describe Gail, who recently graduated from high school the previous June, as a quiet, well-liked girl who spent most of her time taking care of her younger brother, Paul Jr. Gail was a homebody who spent her days doting on her little brother, Paul. Paul Jr. had never gone to school due to his developmental and learning delays and lack of resources for children with disabilities back then. Gail spent most of her free time with her brother trying to teach him about the world around him. They often spent time outside exploring their neighborhood. Family and friends said Gail had very few friends of her own even throughout school and had yet to even go out on a date. Gail preferred being home with her family. Their father, Paul Sr., 43, was an engineer for a crayon manufacturer and also a television repairman on the side, often repairing TVs at home in their basement. Their mother, Buke, 41, was a stay-at-home mom who had entered Paul Sr. and Gail's life after Gail's mother had passed away. Paul Sr.'s job as an engineer gave him access to endless art supplies, which was a blessing for his artistically gifted daughter. Barry Isle of Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, was a cousin of Gail and Paul Jr.'s. Barry would spend the weekend searching the banks of the creek with Paul and Gail looking for rocks. Collecting rocks was one of Gail's favorite pastimes because she was always drawn to odd shapes and colors of each rock. There's an article in the Morning Call, which I will link in the show notes on the Sipping on Some Crime website, that feature Gail's artwork, and you can see that she was quite a talented artist. Barry remembers when Gail sat with him and so patiently taught him how to draw a tree. He remembers her fondly for her patience and her kindness. Saturday, March 7th, 1953, Gail would take her brother, Paul Jr., outside for their daily walk around 2 p.m. Normally on these walks, Paul and Gail would stop at the home of William Brace, whose nickname was Chubby. William would often join Gail and Paul on their afternoon walks, but he wasn't able to join them this time because his father had told him to clean the basement, which he was working on when Gail and Paul arrived at the house. Claire would begin preparing dinner, awaiting for Gail and Paul Jr.'s return when her husband arrived home. When Paul Sr. arrived home around 5 p.m., both Gail and Paul were not home yet, and that was a bit unusual. Paul Sr. and his friend Robert Howells would be down working in their basement repairing a TV when Claire became worried that the children weren't home yet, as it was nearing 5:30. The sun was going down and the temperature was dropping. Claire sent Paul Sr. outside to look for their kids, and Robert decided it was best that he headed home for dinner too and began packing up his tools to leave. While Claire stayed home finishing the dinner prep, Paul Sr. headed outside to look for both kids and tell them to come home because it was time for dinner. Claire watched out the kitchen window as Paul called out for the children. When they didn't answer, Paul Sr. began walking towards the creek that ran through their backyard. That's when Claire would see Paul Sr. suddenly stop and bend over the creek. She said it was the first moment she knew something was wrong. Paul Sr. walked towards the edge of the Black Rock Creek, now called the Shinoak Creek, just 225 yards from their back door to discover two bodies lying face down in about 10 inches of water. That's when Paul Sr. would realize through his shock that this was Gail and Paul Jr. He would drag them both out of the creek onto the shore. At this time, Robert was packing his tools into the car when he heard Paul Sr. shouting and crying for help. When Robert came around the side of the house, that's when he saw Paul Sr. lifting his children out of the water. Robert decided to run into the Schultz home, realizing that there was some type of emergency, and he phoned the family doctor. And as soon as he got off the phone with the doctor, he called to the Nazareth ambulance. While they waited for the doctor and the ambulance to show up, Paul Sr. began frantically performing CPR on his children in an attempt to save them. When the ambulance crew arrived, they continued life-saving measures at the scene until making the decision that both Gail and Paul Jr. would need to go to the Nazareth Fire Company, where even more efforts were made to revive them. The doctor would confirm that both children had passed and at first believed that they drowned. In fact, everybody who was trying to help revive these children had thought they had drowned. Both Gail and Paul's remains would be brought to the Easton Funeral Home, where John Kanatnis, the owner of the funeral home, would be the first to discover fractures in both Gail and Paul's skulls. That's when the coroner from the state police from Bethlehem Barracks would be called in to perform an autopsy, discovering that both Paul and Gail's skulls were indeed fractured. It was discovered that Gail had at least 8 lacerations in her head and Paul was badly beaten, and both were probably attacked with a heavy, blunt object. It wouldn't be until 9:40 p.m. that day, after the funeral home discovered these wounds leading to Gail and Paul Jr.'s death, that investigators would even be notified of this murder. In fact, nobody reached out to the police department from the coroner's office, the funeral home, or the ambulance. The only reason investigators found out about Gail and Paul Jr.'s murder was when a reporter called them looking for information about the case. By the time investigators established that there was a crime and were led to the scene, fresh snow had fallen since the discovery of Gail and Paul's bodies. A lot of evidence was lost in those few days. Not only was the scene disrupted by ambulance workers, Paul Sr., and neighbors, but locals who had heard about this case had trampled back and forth across the creek bed. So any evidence that would have been there was destroyed or lost by time investigators even knew a case existed. 2 days later, Elias Spengler, the Northern Hampton County District Attorney in 1953, informed the press that there was no developments in now what they were calling, quote, the gruesome slaying, unquote, of Gail and Paul Jr. By Tuesday, March 9th, after it was determined that it was now a homicide, Captain Charles Notch of the state police began their homicide investigation by questioning the neighbors and the Schultz family, looking for clues as to who did this. But not just that, but trying to find a motive. Captain Cook, along with the Northampton County District Attorney Spengler, would hold a press conference Tuesday, March 10th at 11 a.m. after an inquest that was scheduled at 10 a.m. called by Coroner Martin Betchold. At the press conference held by District Attorney Spengler, he would tell reporters and the public, quote, we are without clues or motives in this case, unquote. They would share the inquest report from the county pathologist, Dr. Lacombe, which said that there were evidence of water in the lungs for both children, indicating that they were still alive when they entered the water. Dr. Lacram had also established that the children were most likely struck in the head repeatedly with an instrument resembling, quote, a hammer or cultivating tool, unquote. Spengler wanted to confirm that this tool or blunt object had not been found at the scene and had yet to be found at this time. Investigators were also searching for Gail's eyeglasses that she was wearing at the time when she left home. Based on the autopsy report, Dr. Lacombe would state that he believed there was no sexual assault to Gail and that the only injury she suffered below the chin was a fractured right thumb, which they believed happened when she tried to protect herself from being hit in the head. Dr. Lacombe would say that the cause of death for both Gail and Paul would not be drowning despite the water in their lungs, but stated that the injuries from the blows to the children's head and the severity, especially Gail, that those alone were fatal and caused the death for both children. Dr. Lacombe would say both children, quote, were alive when they were placed, fell, or got into that water, unquote. Dr. Lacombe said, however, they ended up in that water. They were unconscious when they entered the creek. 9 days into the investigation and the search of the crime scene, police did find a plastic-handled chisel, but the shank was free of rust, which led police to believe that it was most likely planted there. Also, based on its shape, it could not have made the wounds found in the autopsy. By March 20th, investigators had just cleared one of their first prospects after questioning him for 30 hours. The suspect was a neighbor of the Schultz family and worked as an employee at a steel fabricating firm. Investigators cleared him after he passed a lie detector test. There's no indication as to why he was the suspect in the first place. They just said that they had cleared him. There would be a witness who asked to remain anonymous due to fear of retribution from the killer, who lived in the neighborhood in Eastland Gardens, and told officers that Saturday afternoon, just after 2 p.m., she had seen Gail and Paul walking along the railroad track not far from the housing development. She said that they were not alone and they were walking with a man. She told officers at the time she didn't think much of it until she had heard of their deaths. March 24, 1953, investigators would share with the press that they were looking for a man wearing a tan coat on Saturday, March 7th, who would have been walking in the vicinity of Schoenick Creek in East Lawn Gardens in Nazareth. Not only had the anonymous witness seen this man, but an employee from the Hercules Powder Company saw the same man about an hour earlier and said he saw him walking along the tracks of the Delaware Lackawanna and Western Railroad about 400 yards west of the point where the bodies of Gail and Paul Jr. would be found in the creek. Another suspect that they were asking the public to keep an eye out for was a teenage boy reported to be around the age of 15, seen in the same area as Gail and Paul Jr., and he was seen carrying a grass whip. For those of you who are just like me that said, what is a grass whip? It was essentially a weed whacker. It had a long handle with two metal bars that came out attached to a wooden handle. Those two bars held a metal or steel bar that had ridges cut into it to trim the grass as you whip it in either direction. I will post a picture on my socials and on the Sipping on Some Crime website for those interested in what it looks like so you can picture it and see where investigators were going with this thought. Based on the autopsy and the science that they were using at the time, they would estimate Gail and Paul Jr.'s death around an hour after leaving the house. The way they based the time of death was around the digestion of food in each child's stomach. They knew when they ate lunch based on the contents of their stomach. The autopsy would state that when Paul Sr. found his children around 5:20 p.m., that they had been deceased for about 3 to 3.5 hours, which led investigators to believe that this instance took place in the first few hours that Gail and Paul Jr. left the house to go for their walk. March 11th, a crowd had formed outside of the Katniss Funeral Home on 2101 Northampton Street in Easton to pay their respects to Gail and Paul Jr. Within the first hour, over 250 people had filed into the funeral home to pay their respects. The crowds would continue to visit the funeral home until about 9:30 p.m. This crime shocked the community, not only for the violence of the crime, but for such young lives lost. It was reported as the caskets were lowered, Claire leaned over and cried out, "Goodbye, my children," before collapsing into grief into her husband. Claire could barely manage the strength to walk away from the service as she was escorted to her vehicle by her husband and friends, visibly shaking and crying. Investigators would mingle with a crowd of over 300 people that Tuesday night at the funeral and required each guest to sign in a register before they entered in hopes that the killer would show up. However, as far as we know, this list of mourners didn't lead them to any clues. Because of how much attention this case was beginning to garner with the media, district attorney and some of the investigative team was doing daily press briefings 11 a.m. every day for the first few weeks. As more surrounding areas were picking up the case, the headlines would read, "Sex maniac killer is believed to be responsible for slaying girl and half-brother." State police would tell the press at their daily press conference that they believe it's possible that a sex maniac may have been responsible for Gail and Paul Jr.'s death. Captain Cook would tell the Daily News on March 11, 1953, quote, "The possibility that a sex maniac is responsible is being considered closely, despite the fact that the body of the girl showed no evidence of assault," unquote. Captain Cook wouldn't go on to elaborate why they had come to this theory, yet this theory being publicized caused panic in their community because why wouldn't it? March 16th, about a week into the investigation, at the daily press conference, Captain Cook would inform the press that the parents of Gail and Paul Jr. have been very cooperative and are doing their best to recall each incident in their lives of their children, which may help lead them to clues as to how to even begin to solve this mystery. Captain Cook would say that the investigation was hampered from the beginning by the fact that they didn't even get called out until hours after the bodies were found and removed from the scene. Cook would say that they were still focusing on an intensive search on finding the weapon, but they had recovered Gail's glasses about 42 feet from her, where both bodies were recovered. The only clue they had all week into the investigation was a bloody scarf of Gail's found by the state trooper, Harold Schaefer, about 9 feet from where the bodies were recovered in the creek. Gail's glasses were sent to the state police technical laboratories for testing. Captain Cook and District Attorney Spangler had administered lie detector tests on both Mr. and Mrs. Schultz and said that they have negative results that have been cleared thus far and have been very cooperative with the investigation. Captain Cook said that he was very frustrated after weeks of investigating the case and not getting any closer to solving it, saying, quote, "It seems preposterous that it could have happened in full view of all those East Lawn homes on a clear Saturday afternoon without someone spotting something out of the ordinary," unquote. There seemed to be a promising suspect a week after the murders named Willis R. Keck. He was a 38-year-old bachelor who lived with his 73-year-old mentally challenged father a few doors down from the Schultzes on the same street, Mitchell Avenue. Investigators and neighbors had determined that Willis had returned home early from work that Saturday afternoon, which was unusual. When investigators questioned him what he did that day after he got home, he told investigators that he remained indoors and hadn't left his house until around 8:30 p.m. that evening. What made investigators not believe him was the fact that just a few houses down on the same road of the Schultzes, every neighbor in that area at some point had come out and was milling around and looking at the scene and talking to one another. Investigators found it odd he was the only neighbor to report that he had stayed inside. Investigators would detain and hold Willis for 48 hours. During that time, he would take a lie detector test and be examined by the superintendent of Allentown State Hospital. However, after 2 days of intense questioning and the lie detector test, investigators decided to clear him of any involvement in Gail and Paul Jr.'s case. In April 1953, about 30 days after the discovery of Gail and Paul's bodies, police decided to turn their investigation towards interviewing known sex offenders in their area. By April 4th, Captain Cook had reported over 124 known offenders had already been questioned, and they only had a few left on their list that they were interested in questioning. The Northampton County Commissioner's Office would offer a $1,000 reward for information leading to the arrest of the killer of Gail and Paul. Eastern Express also offered an additional $1,000 reward, and the company that Paul Sr. worked at, Biney & Smith Co., offered a $500 reward with no deadline. Biney and Smith not only offered a reward, but they even paid to hire a private investigator and to have a prominent criminologist from Chicago be brought in to help investigators review the case. The death of these children in such a nice community, what was supposed to be a safe place, definitely rocked this community's sense of security, and they were demanding answers. Despite the intense investigation, where police officers questioned over 400 people and garnered lots of media attention, Paul and Gail's case was still unsolved a year later. They were no closer to discovering who killed Paul and Gail and why. Northampton County Commissioner would renew the $1,000 reward for another year in hopes that someone would come forward with information or clues on this case. In July 1953, a judge would rule that the balance of $19,057 of a trust fund left to Gail in 1951 by Meanie Ramley Wilson Burrow would be turned over and donated to the Zion Lutheran Church of Easton. Judge William Frack came to the decision after auditing and confirming the account was left to Gail. In the will that bequeathed this amount to Gail, it was stipulated that in her death, the trust fund was to go to the church. In late July, early August, there's no clear defined date in any reports, but we do know that Captain Cook, the lead investigator on Gail and Paul Jr.'s case from the beginning, would unexpectedly pass away. At that point, the investigation would be handed over to Harold Schaefer of the state police. In September of 1954, investigators were no closer to solving Gail and Paul's case, and the Schultz family will take another hard hit. September 2nd, after Paul Sr. returned home from work, had his evening meal with his wife, Claire, he told Claire that he was going out that night to Easton. Paul Sr. left the house at about 6:45 p.m., but would return 15 minutes later telling Claire that he was suffering from pains in his chest. Claire would call the doctor, Earl Hartman, who would come over to the house and speak with Paul Sr., who seemed to be responding and feeling better. Dr. Hartman would barely arrive back to his office to receive a call from Claire, who asked Dr. Hartman to come back. By the time Hartman made it back to the Schultz home, Paul Sr. would pass away within moments of his arrival. After losing so much, Claire would decide to sell their home and move to Buffalo, New York to live with relatives. She had an older son from a previous marriage in Buffalo, so she would move to be closer to him and other family. She would die in 1970, never getting the answers as to who and why someone murdered her children. As the years went on, family members of Paul and Gail theorized that it was possible that an unstable person that lived in the neighborhood may have been involved in the death of Paul and Gail. However, police never questioned or pursued this person. As the years passed, Gail and Paul's case definitely got swallowed by time. We wouldn't see Gail or Paul Jr.'s file updated with any information until October of 1987, and that was due to a concerned citizen writing a letter to the state police about their worry that 35 years had gone without this case ever being solved. In 2010, Barry, who was 66 at the time, and the only remaining relative who had known Gail and Paul Jr. before their deaths, was still fighting to get their case solved. By 2010, he'd already written numerous letters to investigators and reporters, pleading for attention to be focused on Gail and Paul Jr.'s case. Barry said, quote, "Everybody forgets it, and I feel like I'm pretty much the only one who still remembers. It's just me. It's a lot for one person to bear," unquote. In 2010, District Attorney John Maganelli said investing in a grand jury to hear Gail and Paul's case at this point would be a waste of resources, saying, quote, "There's been absolutely no information on the case whatsoever in recent years," unquote. Maganelli would say that the police never brought this case to his attention during the grand jury session in 1999, and it wasn't until he received a letter from Barry to the district attorney's office that prosecutors had even heard of Paul and Gail's case. District Attorney Maganelli in 2010 said the suspect is most likely dead. Trooper Raymond Judge was the cold case investigator in 2010 for the Bethlehem State Police Barracks, and he said no matter how old all homicide cases become, they remain open until they are solved. When it came to Gail and Paul's case, unfortunately, there have not been any new leads for years, and many of those involved in the case have died. Time had even changed so much of East Lawn Gardens. The neighbors that once lived there had come and gone. The Schultz house stood empty and unoccupied for a bit after Claire left until new owners from miles away that had never heard of the murder moved in 3 years later. After moving in, they were informed of the murder, and their house was somewhat a landmark in the neighborhood. But eventually, the story of what happened to those children would fade from the neighbors' memories. The housing development itself would grow with more houses lining the streets. A school would be built close by, and its football field sits where the old cornfield used to sit next to the Shonick Creek. That creek that neighbors used to warn their children to stay away from was now full of life as children play in the neighborhood. Now today, it has been 70 years later, and their case is still not solved. Barry Isles would pass away March 2022, leaving photos and this family mystery to his daughter, Tammy Holmes. Around here, we don't ever expect that a case can't be solved, despite prosecutors, district attorneys, investigators not wanting to finish this case because they feel it's impossible. It's not. The best thing that you can do to help Paul Jr. and Gail's case is to continue to talk about it. The secrets to what happened to them may lie with another family. The only way forward is to continue to share their face and their stories. Thank you so much for tuning into another episode, and please share Gail and Paul Jr.'s story in whatever format makes you comfortable, including word of mouth. If you are listening on Apple and Spotify, please hit that subscribe button and leave a review. That does help get these cases to more ears. Remember, when you see those missing and murdered posts on social media, to hit like, share, and retweet. Every time we share a face, we get closer to solving a case. Until next time.